Welcome to the HR Power Hour, presented by Career Management Associates. I'm David Chulo. It's about all things in the human resource world. We're going to bring in local, regional, and national guests, and we're going to talk about a variety of topics and explain why human resource management is critical to your business success so that you can make decisions to keep and retain great talent.
Welcome to the HR Power Hour, presented by CMAcareer.com and Verrill-Law.com. I'm Tanya Alvarez, your host from Verrill, and today our guest is Elizabeth Johnston, an attorney in the Labor and Employment Practice Group at Verrill. Welcome, Liz.
Thanks. Happy to be here.
So today we're going to talk about the importance of not forgetting employers' general obligations in the midst of focusing on COVID-19. You and I have talked a lot in the past, and I mean the recent past, but we've spoken about it a lot. And that's specifically the issues related to the fact that while we have all these new regulations coming out from both the state and the federal government, when we're looking at stay-at-home orders, when we're looking at the PPP under the CARES Act, when we're looking at the Families First Coronavirus Response Act, it's really, really easy for us to get into the pocket or within the box in which that's all we're thinking about. And then we forget about all of our general duty responsibilities under statutes and acts that we have been dealing with for the course of our professional careers, but that we forget about because of the change in circumstances. So I appreciate you taking time out of your day to have this conversation and to share your experiences and some of the things that you've been seeing.
Yeah, absolutely. I completely agree with all of this new legislation coming out. It's so easy to isolate these new laws and our responsibilities under these new laws. But it's so important to keep in mind just the breadth of other things that we need to consider from, you know, those regular state discrimination laws and employment laws to the federal laws governing the same thing, and learning how to mesh all of that together to make sure that we're covering all of our bases when we have issues or thinking about how to deal with an employee issue.
And I think that you make a really important point there is we're not just dealing with federal legislation here. We're talking about state and federal responsibilities. So not just our HR professionals kind of dealing with things from what the new federal guidance is, but they're also then looking at how that interrelates with the states they operate in, which may be multiple. And then also the decisions that they're making that could have effects on very state-specific type issues, such as workers' compensation and unemployment. So these aspects that have always been very state-driven also play a huge role in where we find ourselves today, in addition to the fact that many states have similar legislation as to paid leave, as to Fair Employment Practices, acts that are similar either to the ADA or the EEOC laws and Title VII. So I'm excited for us to have a conversation and really kind of dig into all of those different theories or aspects. But first, I think it would be great for our listeners to learn a little bit more about you and your practice.
Yeah, sure. So as you mentioned, I'm an attorney at Verrill in the Labor and Employment Group. My practice generally focuses on all aspects of employment law, including defending against employment discrimination claims, harassment and retaliation claims, and that's both at the administrative agency level as well as in Maine state and federal courts. I also practice workers' compensation in the state of Maine, advise on wage and hour issues, and also advise on those state and federal employment laws that we were talking about, such as the Maine Human Rights Act, the FMLA. My practice involves reviewing employee handbooks, making sure that those are compliant with state and federal laws, preparing employment agreements, and the like.
I think one of the other really interesting things about your practice is that before going into private practice, you worked for the court system. So you worked in a clerking situation. And I find that that always provides attorneys with kind of a different way to look at problems from the same way as potentially the bench or the court may see issues once they get before them. And I think that helps employers when you're advising them to identify the things that the court is going to focus on and see when those choices are being made. And before we get to litigation, with hope we never get to litigation, but if that were the case, that you have that insight generally.
Yeah, it's sort of like having a view from the finish line and looking at how a court might evaluate an argument or a situation and how they would look at that in a practical perspective and how a certain case or a certain fact pattern might create law that impacts situations down the line. So I think I agree. It does give me sort of that perspective more on a global basis that allows me to advocate in the most effective way.
So considering the topic that we're dealing with, I thought that one of the best ways for us to handle it would be for us to do some hypothetical situations that we could walk through with listeners so that they can think about how these hypothetical situations likely are similar to issues that they've been faced with and decrease kind of their anxiety regarding how to handle some of these issues or provide them just with a checklist of things they should be focusing on during the course of some of these issues. So if it sounds good with you, I'll throw out a hypothetical situation and we can go from there. Sound good?
Yeah, let's dive in.
Okay, so Employee A, we'll call him. Employee A works at a business with 75 employees that remains open and has been deemed an essential business by the state. The employee calls into work and says that they are showing symptoms of COVID-19, fever, trouble breathing, and are working with a healthcare provider to get tested. Last week, another employee who this employee works closely with also tested positive for COVID-19. So you expect that this employee will receive a positive test result. How do you respond in this situation? And I'm going to kind of just generally open it up, and there may be things that I think our listeners are immediately saying, oh, we've got this issue and that issue, but just a couple of things. Recall that your business, you've been deemed essential, you remain open and operational, and you have 75 employees, but last week you had an employee who tested positive for COVID-19 who works closely with the employee who is currently calling in sick. What's the first thing that comes to mind for you, Liz?
Yeah, well, I think in this day and age, the first thing that's going to come to mind is whether that employee is going to be entitled to any paid leave under the Family First Coronavirus Response Act. If the employee is calling in sick and is experiencing symptoms of COVID-19, we probably don't want them to be interacting with other employees at the workplace, and that employee could be entitled to paid leave under the new federal legislation and then Paid Sick Leave Act within Families First. So in this case, if we have a business that has 75 employees, they would be covered under the Families First Act because they're under that 500 employee threshold. So Families First Act provides that employees will be entitled to 80 hours or 2 weeks of paid leave at their regular rate or up to $511 a week if they're unable to work due to a variety of qualifying reasons. And one of those reasons is if the employee is experiencing COVID-19 symptoms and seeking a medical diagnosis for that condition, which is the case here. So we want to also be thinking about the amount of leave that employee would be entitled to based on if they are full-time or part-time. In order to figure out how much pay they would be entitled to. But in this case, that's sort of where I would start is determining if they would be qualified under Families First, and it looks like they would.
I think that's a really important, I mean, in this situation, the hypothetical is, I don't want to say clean cut, but he said that, or she, because I didn't give the employee a gender, but the employee has indicated that they're showing symptoms of COVID-19. I think one of the things that sometimes we forget, however, is to be regularly checking the CDC website to find out what those symptoms are as they evolve. If someone calls and says that they're having stomach pains, it's important that you check to find out whether or not the CDC is indicating whether or not stomach cramping or those type of things are currently considered to be symptoms of COVID-19. And this isn't relying upon news outlets or other things that you're seeing, but go directly to the source. Go to the CDC website and see what they're saying.
Yeah, that's so important because there can be so much misinformation out there. And the CDC is the guidance that employers should be following to understand what the current risk levels are, risk factors for employees, and whether certain symptoms are relevant to COVID-19 at that point.
And I think one of the most helpful things that's been created by the Department of Labor is the employee rights poster that employers need to have posted in their workplace. I mean, it's easy to get swallowed up by the frequently asked questions that are listed on the Federal Department of Labor website. But if you continuously return to the employee rights poster that everyone should have posted, you're going to very clearly see the 6 qualifying reasons to take paid leave under the Families First Coronavirus Response Act. And it includes, just like you said, the experiencing the symptoms and seeking the medical diagnosis, but it's also going to set forth stuff such as the local quarantine orders, federal, state quarantine or isolation orders regarding COVID-19, or specifically being advised by a healthcare provider to self-quarantine.
Yeah, exactly. It's a very accessible poster, and it also has the information available about employees who need leave to care for children whose school or childcare is closed due to COVID-19. I think that poster serves as a really great informative tool for your employees as well as for you as an employer if you need a quick reference.
One of the other things I'm wondering or thinking about, I mean, my hypothetical was really, really vague, but should we be considering telework in any sense with regards to this issue?
Yeah, absolutely. One of the caveats actually about the Families First Act is that it will protect or provide paid sick leave when the employee is unable to work or telework. So if the employee is able to telework, potentially even if they are experiencing symptoms or if they're under a quarantine order that would otherwise qualify, teleworking can be an option. And if the employee is able to do so, then they wouldn't necessarily be entitled to paid leave under the Act.
You're listening to the HR Power Hour radio show, and I'm your host, Tawny Alvarez. And today we're talking to Elizabeth Johnston, an attorney in the Labor and Employment Practice Group at Verrill. And we're going through a hypothetical situation to remind ourselves of all the other state, local, and even federal statutes that are applicable to your employment issues during the course of the COVID-19 pandemic. Specifically, we're looking at the fact that while our minds may be focused on the Families First Coronavirus Response Act and other new legislation that's come out, we need to be mindful that there's other regulations and rules that are applicable. So what are some other, we've just identified that the paid leave under Families First could be applicable. Are there other things that we need to be mindful of with this hypothetical?
Yeah, so we talked a little bit about how we're focusing so much on the Families First Act and this new federal legislation, but you know, it's important to remember that we're dealing with medical issues here. And employees who end up having symptoms of COVID-19 or a diagnosis or having family members who need to be cared for if they are suffering from COVID-19, these employees might also qualify for regular FMLA. So I think it's important that we think about what happens after that 2 weeks, after the paid leave is over, and what our responsibilities are going to be to employees after that period, depending on what circumstances they continue to experience. So
is that something that employers should be thinking about now, or should they be thinking about it in 2 weeks once the employee is either still sick or is able to return to work?
I think it's important to think about it early and be ready to have those discussions. If you have an employee who after the 2 weeks is still experiencing illness or has a sick family member, you want to be ready to go to have that conversation about whether or not they're going to continue to need leave, whether you're going to have to cover, make up for an absence or have that employee out of work. And also to get your paperwork together so that you can provide notice of the employee's rights to take FMLA and appropriate doctor certification forms if appropriate. And it's you should also be thinking about whether a specific employee would qualify. We know in this case that the employer has 75 employees, and the FMLA is going to apply to an employer with 50 or more employees within 75 miles of the employee's work site. So we want to make sure that those boxes are checked, so to speak, and also whether the employee is needing individual qualifications, such as being employed by you for 12 months prior to needing leave and having worked the 1,250 minimum hours in order to be qualified.
Those are really great points, and I actually want to talk more about that. But right now, we're going to take a break. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on Newstalk WLOB 100.5 FM and WLOBRadio.com. We'll be right back.
Are you looking to hire? Stop wasting time. JobsInME.com has been matching main employers to job seekers since 1999. Job postings start at only $159 with their QuickPost product. Your employment ad can be distributed to over 75 job boards for maximum exposure. When it comes to recruiting locally, you can count on JobsInME to connect you with qualified candidates in this area. Visit JobsInME.com. That's JobsInME.com today. Stop searching and start hiring locally.
At 154 years old, Verrill Dana has an illustrious history and more than seven generations of legal expertise. With more than 130 attorneys across seven offices from Maine to Washington, D.C., Verrill Dana serves clients across the country and around the world. HR professionals, business leaders, and in-house counsel count on Verrill Dana, one of the premier labor and employment law practices in the Northeast. Contact them today at verrilldana.com.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour, presented by CMAcareer.com and verrill-law.com. I'm Tawny Alvarez from Verrill, your host. And I'm talking with Elizabeth Johnson, an attorney in the Labor and Employment Practice Group at Verrill. We're discussing the importance of not forgetting general obligations in the midst of the COVID-19 pandemic. It's really easy for us to focus just on Families First Coronavirus Response Act or aspects of the PPP if you've received a loan under the CARES Act or generally focusing on health and safety measures that you're taking within the workplace. And sometimes, and more often than not, it's easy to forget the general obligations that we as employers have to our employees during this time, which are unchanged from before the pandemic hit. Prior to the break, Liz was sharing some information regarding the hypothetical situation we have where we have an employee who works at what's been deemed to be an essential employer who has indicated that the employee is experiencing COVID-19 symptoms of a fever and shortness of breath and who is getting medical attention. And we were talking about different statutes that apply. And prior to the break, Liz had just mentioned the FMLA. Now, Liz, once we've determined that the FMLA could be applicable, that the employees worked over 1,250 hours, We know the employer has over 50 employees. What is the next thing that that employer needs to be doing?
So if the employee qualifies with their 12 months and their 1,250 hours in the prior year, then it's, you know, at this point, we'd want to look at whether the reason that the employee needs leave actually qualifies under the FMLA. So again, this could be for a serious health condition of the employee or for of an employee's family member. And in this case, COVID-19 potentially is a serious medical condition. There's the potential to be out of work for a substantial amount of time, the potential to need medical treatment. But it's important to remember here that we're not medical providers ourselves. So we don't want to be making any judgments or our own assessments about whether the employee's condition qualifies as a serious medical condition. So what we would want to do is provide the employee with the paperwork to get a doctor's certification, as well as that notice of rights and responsibilities. We would want to give that to the employee so we could start the process in getting that certification to make sure that it is qualifying.
I think if we were to change the scenario around a little bit more as well, and something that I know we've both been getting a lot of phone calls about is individuals who maybe are out of work because they are in a high-risk category because they have some pre-existing condition. In a lot of situations, employers are finding out about these pre-existing conditions for the first time. In some cases, they're questioning the validity of that, but recall that that's not our position or our place to be questioning the validity. What we need to be doing is simply providing the appropriate documentation and asking the employee to have a healthcare professional document this need. So if someone has asthma, which previously hadn't affected their ability to do the job, as a result of COVID-19, maybe it is affecting their ability to do the job and therefore could qualify as a serious health condition in the current state of affairs. So I think it's important that all employers are mindful of that fact. And if we're in a state that has its own FMLA, should we be mindful of those state responsibilities as well?
Oh, of course. And that's the case if we were operating under normal circumstances, too. Many states do have their own sort of mini family medical leave acts. And Maine is actually one of them. And this could affect both whether or not you as an employer are required to provide any sort of protected leave, even if you don't qualify based on your size under the federal FMLA, a state FMLA law could still apply. So in Maine's case, Maine FMLA applies to employers with work sites of 15 or more employees, and it provides 10 weeks of leave over a two-year period. So a little bit different than federal FMLA, but it's still important to think about whether or not you as an employer would qualify under a state FMLA.
Another thing that I think is important to note, Liz, is can you provide guidance to our listeners about what to do if their employees have already used all available FMLA time? Does COVID-19 restart a new clock?
It doesn't necessarily start a new clock, but the Families First Act would provide leaves in addition to anything that's been provided already. So if FMLA is exhausted, then an employee might not be entitled to additional FMLA leave after the leave under the Families First Act is exhausted, but it would provide leave that's separate from and in addition to FMLA leave that's already been used or could be used.
I think that this is a really good point that you make about all aspects of the FMLA. So we've talked about the Families First Coronavirus Response Act. We've talked about the FMLA. Are there any other statutes that we should be keeping at top of mind during the course of this hypothetical response?
Yeah, I would say the Americans with Disabilities Act is a really important one that we need to be considering as well. And Tawny, when you were talking about employees that potentially have a condition that would render them immunocompromised or put them at some additional risk to contract COVID-19, that raises a host of different issues for the employee and the employer during this tricky time. So in those cases where you have an employee who might be immunocompromised, that could potentially be a case that we need to consider ADA accommodations and whether or not an employer can provide a reasonable accommodation for an employee if they would qualify as having a disability. So, you know, we need to keep considering whether or not the ADA might apply in addition to requirements and whether or not an employee might need a reasonable accommodation, even if they're not qualified for leave under Families First or FMLA.
And I think that's a really good point. So in the last hypothetical that we were discussing, when I said, do you get more FMLA leave, and if it's already all been used, that there might not be any additional FMLA leave available. But that doesn't mean that someone who has COVID-19 but is out of any form of paid leave can simply be terminated for not coming to work. We're going to enter into that ADA accommodation dialogue.
Absolutely. You'd enter into the ADA accommodation dialogue and see if there is an accommodation that can be made in order to allow the employee to continue working and performing the essential functions of their job. And of course, it's illegal to discriminate or retaliate against an employee for having a disability or taking FMLA leave. So if you have an employee who's going to need leave for the FMLA or need a reasonable accommodation, we should be cautious when we're considering potentially taking action to separate the employee or terminate employment or treat them differently.
You're listening to the HR Power Hour radio show. I'm your host, Tani Alvarez, and today we're talking to Elizabeth Johnston, an attorney in the Labor and Employment Practice Group at Verrill. Our discussion today has been focusing on making sure that you see the full picture in the midst of the COVID-19 pandemic. So while it's really easy to focus on new legislation that's been coming out regarding employer-employee relations, specifically the Families First Coronavirus Response Act, it is so important that we also look at things such as the ADA, the FMLA, and other employee protection and rights and responsibilities laws. Now, Liz, we've been using this hypothetical, but what we know and what was set forth in my hypothetical at the beginning was that we had a coworker who tested positive earlier in the week. Does that factor of the hypothetical play into the analysis or things that we should be doing in the current situation?
Yeah, the other consideration here is whether this is a workers' compensation issue. Workers' compensation will provide the employee with additional benefits if they have an injury or illness that arose in and out of employment. So because here we have an employee who is working closely with another employee who actually tested positive, there's certainly a risk for that employee to have been exposed to COVID-19 at work. So there's potentially a workers' compensation claim here.
So we're getting, or I'm guessing you're also getting lots of questions about, like, well, what is my comp carrier going to do, or what will they say? Is this really going to be considered a workers' comp claim? Because how can they prove that they caught it through work? What happens if there's factors that show that, in fact, their spouse or significant other also tested positive for COVID-19 because they were an essential worker and they had a coworker who also tested positive? Is it employer's place to kind of be hashing through those issues, or what should an employer do in this situation from a practical standpoint?
Yeah, so, you know, that's the tricky part about illnesses at work, is that the employee will have a burden to show that this was an illness that developed because of the employment and during the employment, out of the employment. And that's ultimately going to be an issue for an administrative law judge to decide. So it's not an employer's place to be making a decision or a judgment or a conclusive argument about whether or not the employee contracted COVID-19 at work or at the grocery store or through a family member. But it's really case by case. So the employer can take a few different routes here if they have this situation. If the employer has a belief, a reasonable belief that the employee did contract the COVID-19 through a coworker, it might be a good idea to file a first report of injury to the Workers' Compensation Board. Otherwise, if the employee does end up making a claim down the road, the employer could file a notice of controversy to controvert the claim if they don't believe that the employee contracted COVID-19 through the coworker, and that would start sort of a litigious process in workers' compensation.
I think that's really helpful for employers to know and to understand. And while I don't think all employers are experiencing something to this effect, I think that there are a number of essential workers or employers who may be seeing either an upswing or employees who are vocally kind of discussing this fear or concern. Right now, though, let's change up the hypothetical kind of a little bit. Let's say that hypothetically the employee unfortunately does test positive for COVID-19. The good news is, though, is after 2 weeks on leave, the employee is feeling better but indicates that they are still tired. But despite this, they want to return to work, but they can only do so part-time. What would your response be or your recommended response to employers in a situation such as this?
First step, I think, would be to have a conversation with the employee, to figure out where the employee's at. It sounds like the employee wants to return to work part-time, but having that dialogue and that conversation to make sure that this is a good option both for the employee's health and for what they're looking to do, maybe talk about if there's any additional time off that the employee needs or is able to take. But if the employee does come back, I'm a little concerned about the fact that they're very tired. The fact that they want to work part-time could be an accommodation for any ongoing medical issue that's going on, but safety is still important. And depending on the industry and the type of employer that you are, being tired could potentially be a safety risk. So I think what I would do here is ask the employee to do a fitness for duty exam and get a doctor's note to make sure that they're able to work and that the work that they would be doing is safe considering there are any ongoing issues.
So even if the employee is testing negative for COVID-19, that it's out of their system, the employer still has the right to require a return to duty or fitness for duty exam upon returning to work, correct?
Yeah, that's correct. They can do that, especially here where there's a potential safety issue with the fatigue that's ongoing. But the employer is able to request a fitness for duty in that case.
Now, some employers will often say, at my workplace, you can't come back unless you're 100%. Is there problems with a requirement or a policy such as that?
Yeah, there definitely is, and this comes back to ADA issues as well as potentially FMLA issues. So I mentioned that a part-time schedule might be an ADA issue, and that's because a part-time schedule is potentially a reasonable accommodation. So employers that are covered are required to provide employees with reasonable accommodations to qualified individuals with disabilities, and that's to allow the employees to continue doing those essential functions of the job. Now, employers aren't necessarily required to entirely change a job or eliminate essential functions of the employee's job as an accommodation. However, taking a part-time or even a reduced schedule might be an accommodation that's reasonable if it allows the employee to continue working, especially if that's the only sort of accommodation that can be made to the schedule and it's what the employee is asking for. The exception would be if that accommodation would pose an undue hardship on an employer, but that's generally a very high standard. And even if that was the case, then the employer might also need to consider reassigning the employee to a different position.
Liz, I think that those are really, really great points that you make, and generally something that I think oftentimes employers forget in a hope of getting people back to work as quickly as possible, or just trying to figure out what the schedules are going to be from an operational standpoint. Are there any other things that should be at top of mind in this situation?
Well, I would also consider the FMLA in a situation like this where an employee is asking for a reduced schedule or a modified schedule. The FMLA can provide other protections because FMLA can be taken intermittently. So if an employee needed time off for medical appointments or for a condition that flares up or has certain periods of time where that might require the employee to take a part-time or a different schedule, the employer might be required to provide that on an FMLA basis, and that would be even if the different schedule would cause undue hardship under the ADA. So it's really important to remember that those FMLA protections for medical needs will still also apply in many cases if the employer is a covered employer in addition to the ADA.
I think that those are some really, really good points, Liz. Thanks for that. We're going to take a quick break. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM and WLOBradio.com. We'll be right back.
Are you looking to hire? Stop wasting time. JobsInME.com has been matching Maine employers to job seekers since 1999. Job postings start at only $159 with their QuickPost product. Your employment ad can be distributed to over 75 job boards for maximum exposure. When it comes to recruiting locally, you can count on JobsInME to connect you with qualified candidates in this area. Visit JobsInME.com. That's JobsInME.com today. Stop searching and start hiring locally.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at JacksonLewis.com. That's JacksonLewis.com.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com and Verrill-Law.com. I'm Tani Alvarez from Verrill, your host, and I'm talking with Elizabeth Johnston, an attorney in the Labor and Employment Practice Group at Verrill. We're discussing the importance of not forgetting all of the general obligations that employers have in the midst of the COVID-19 pandemic. It's really easy to focus on the Families First Coronavirus Response Act and health and safety concerns of your employees and forget some of the basic leave requirements that you've been working with and dealing with throughout the course of your career. So we've been doing this in a hypothetical scenario in which an employee calls out sick, indicating that they have COVID-19 symptoms, and we've been going through all the different things that one should keep at top of mind. Liz, we've talked about the ADA, we've talked about the FMLA, we've talked about workers' comp. Let's focus our attention a little bit on maybe not just the statutory requirements that could be in play here, but how the employer's policies or practices could also play a leave in how the employer should respond in these situations.
Sure. So when it comes to employer policies and how they apply in these situations, it's really important to look back at what the policy actually says, how it's drafted, and making sure that we're applying it in the same way to everyone that is covered by that policy. So to figure out how it might play into other types of leave, you should look and see if the policy is drafted to run concurrently with other leave laws, whether paid leave provided by the employer is in addition to other types of sick leave or unpaid leave, and really get an idea of the full breadth of leave options that we're dealing with here. But again, looking back to the text and looking back to how it's written and how it's been applied in the past, the other thing that we need to look at is whether those state and federal leave laws are covering the same sort of circumstances as believed by the employer's policies. And sometimes the state and federal laws will openly provide that they can't be taken at the same time or substituted by employer policies for paid leave or things like that. So it's sort of case by case. I know it's a gray area as with a lot of things in employment law, but it's important to really dive into that language and figure out whether it has to be taken in addition to something else or if it can overlap.
And I think that's a good point. And when we're talking about not forgetting anything from the past or making sure that you are following your policies and past practices is really important here, because while we are in the middle of a pandemic and it's tough to make a lot of these choices, if you call your attorney or if you call for guidance, I mean, one of the first things that a lot of employment counsel is going to say is, what have you done in the past, correct? So we're going to ask employers to look at their policies and then also find out what some of the past behaviors were in order to, with hope, decrease any arguments of discrimination, right, Liz?
Oh, exactly, because, you know, in these cases right now, we're potentially applying these policies to people with possible disabilities or possible medical conditions or who are taking FMLA or leave under Families First. And so that, I think, almost increases the risk more than normal, that if it was applied differently to these groups of people right now, that would be a risky situation.
You're listening to the HR Power Hour radio show. I'm your host, Tawny Alvarez, and today we're talking to Liz Johnston, an attorney in the Labor and Employment Practice Group at Verrill. Liz, I want to go back and I want to change the hypothetical a little. I know I've already changed it twice, but let's say that once the employee returns to work, so the employee is healed, they've gotten a return to work form from their healthcare provider, and now they're back at work. But once they return, they start vocally complaining about work conditions. So they're talking to other people and arguing that they should be entitled to some form of hazard pay for having to continue to work during the pandemic. You're trying to just operate and focus on operations and maintaining your business. You want to discipline the employee because you believe they're being disruptive at work, but your boss wants to fire the employee. How would you respond in a situation such as this?
Yeah, Tawny, this is a really tough one that I think a lot of employers are dealing with right now. This is tricky because on the one hand, we have an employee who's being disruptive, but on the other hand, we have the National Labor Relations Act, which potentially protects the employee's behavior. So specifically, I'm talking about Section 7 of the NLRA, and that protects employees' rights to engage in concerted activity, which can include making complaints or statements about their work conditions. And that's a really broad overview of that. But if the employee is complaining or talking about the work conditions and potential safety risks, even as they perceive them, that's potentially protected behavior under the NLRA. Because it's protected behavior under the NLRA, I would be hesitant to impose discipline right away. That could potentially be problematic. And so I think, you know, a good place to start is speaking with the employee about their behavior and what their concerns are and opening that dialogue.
I think that that's a really good point, Liz, is being mindful of all of these statutes. Is this going to be the case only in a unionized workforce? Is this only going to be problematic if your work environment has a union, or is this a general requirement that all employers are going to have to be mindful of?
This is a general requirement that all employers have to be mindful of, whether unionized or not unionized. There might be different standards that apply, different sort of you know, rules, procedural aspects of what happens later on. But this type of behavior or this type of activity is potentially protected regardless of union status. But I do, you know, while it might be protected behavior, the NLRA doesn't protect necessarily every type of disruptive behavior. So I would say if you are dealing with these issues, it's not a lost cause or something that nothing can be done about, and it's potentially worth exploring further, speaking to counsel about.
Those are really great points, Liz. We're going to take a break. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM and WLOBradio.com. We'll be right back.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at JacksonLewis.com. That's JacksonLewis.com.
Are you looking to hire? Stop wasting time. JobsandME.com has been matching Maine employers to job seekers since 1999. Job postings start at only $159 with their QuickPost product. Your employment ad can be distributed to over 75 job boards for maximum exposure. When it comes to recruiting locally, you can count on JobsandME to connect you with qualified candidates in this area. Visit JobsandME.com. That's JobsandME.com today. Stop searching and start hiring locally.
And we're back. You're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com and Verrill-Law.com. I'm Tani Alvarez from Verrill, your host, and I'm talking with Elizabeth Johnston, an attorney in the Labor and Employment Practice Group at Verrill. We've been discussing the importance of not forgetting general obligations in the midst of the COVID-19 pandemic. We've been talking a lot about just being mindful of all the leave requirements and other fair employment practices statutes that are applicable in so many of the situations that employers are being faced with right now. Liz, prior to the break, we were talking a little bit about a hypothetical in which an employee becomes a bit disruptive in the work environment, arguing that they should be entitled to hazard pay or those similar type precautions. Do you have any other guidance as to things that employers, specifically HR representatives, should be focusing on in the midst of our current environment with the COVID-19 pandemic?
Sure. You know, I think one thing that we need to keep in mind is that, you know, this is a really difficult time for everybody. We talked about an employee who was potentially being disruptive in the workplace because of safety concerns or not getting hazard pay and things like that. But it's important to remember that a lot of this behavior, or these feelings, might come out of a place of real uncertainty and fear at the situation and what's going to happen, both with their families and their employment and their life. And it's really important as an employer to practice empathy throughout all of this. And I know that employers are dealing with a lot right now from all of the new legislation, balancing that with all of the existing federal and state obligations that you have. But being empathetic and keeping that open dialogue with your employees and trying to work together on a resolution is really important, both from a human perspective, but also to reducing risk down the line. Letting your employees know that you're there for them and willing to work with them and communicate with them is an effective way to reduce risk and also maintain your workplace throughout this uncertainty.
I think those are some really important points, Liz. So often employees and people just want to be heard. They just want an outlet in order for them to voice either concerns or fears or all of those different things. And in some situations, they may have questions that you may not be able to answer And it's interesting because during the course of all this, I've been doing a lot of reading and a lot of talking with individuals. And sometimes the only right answer is, I don't know. When employees are asking what's going to happen next week or next month or how the employer is going to respond to certain changes, there likely are going to be times within the course of this process where we're going to respond with, I don't know. And being honest with our employees and hearing what their fears are and also just kind of giving them a glimpse as to what we're dealing with is oftentimes so helpful in reducing the risk generally for the organization.
Absolutely.
So Liz, I think as a recap, it's important for employers to be focusing on different leave statutes as well as health-related accommodation type issues, and also focusing on the fact that none of their behavior is retaliatory in the long run. So recalling that the ADA, the FMLA, and OSHA all have anti-retaliation provisions in them, I think are really important factors that employers should have as a takeaway for things to be mindful of in addition to the Families First Coronavirus Response Act. Anything else, Liz, that you think we might be forgetting?
I think we've covered it for today, Tawny.
Well, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it, and so do our listeners.
Thanks so much for having me.
You've been listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM and WLOBradio.com. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week. Stay tuned for the HR Tip of the Week.
And now, your HR Tip of the Week. Your HR Tip of the Week is being sponsored by Verrill.
Employment applications can tell you a lot about a candidate, but are yours telling you too much? Hi, I'm Liz Johnston at Verrill. It's common practice to ask potential hires to complete an application when they are applying for a job, but it's important to be mindful of what you are asking to avoid potential liability later on. Avoid questions that might reveal a protected characteristic of an applicant. For example, asking for someone's graduation year from high school or college might be telling as to their age. Instead, simply ask what degree was received. There are also statutory restrictions to watch out for, such as new Maine laws that prohibit asking for Social Security numbers on initial applications, as well as Maine's pay equity law, which provides that employers cannot ask for or consider past salary figures of an applicant. If you have questions about whether you are asking the right questions on your employment applications, contact me or a member of Verrill's Employment and Labor Group.
And that's your HR Tip of the Week, sponsored by Verrill. Thank you, everyone, for listening, and catch us every week at 10 a.m. on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM or 1310 a.m. and streaming live at WLOBradio.com. Podcasts of this show and every show are available at HRPowerHour.com. Have a great week, everyone, and remember, HR management is critical to your business's success.